Life and Death of the Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. One evening of late summer, before the 19th century had reached one-third of its span, a young man and woman, the latter carrying a child, were approaching the large village of Weydon Priors in Upper Wessex on foot. They were plainly but not ill-clad, though the thick hoard of dust which had accumulated on their shoes and garments from an obviously long journey lent a disadvantageous shabbiness to their appearance. The man was a fine figure, swarthy and stern in aspect. The woman enjoyed no society whatever from his presence. Virtually, she walked the highway alone, save for the child she was carrying. That the man and woman were husband and wife, and the parents of the girl in arms, there could be little doubt. No other than such relationship would have accounted for the atmosphere of stale familiarity which the trio carried along with them, like a nimbus as they moved down the road. When the outlying houses of Weydon Priors could just be descried, the family group was met by a turnip hoer with his hoe on his shoulder and his dinner bag suspended from it.
"Any trade doing here?" the man asked phlegmatically. "Anything in the hay-trussing line?"
The turnip hoer had already begun shaking his head.
"Why, save the man. What wisdom's in him that I should have come to Weydon for a job of that sort this time of year?"
The hay-trusser, which he obviously was, nodded with some superciliousness. Looking towards the village, he continued,
"There is something going on here, however, is there not?" "Aye, 'tis fair day."
The trusser and his family proceeded on their way, and soon entered the fair field. They looked around for a refreshment tent among the many which dotted the down. Two which stood nearest to them seemed almost equally inviting. One announced good home-brewed beer, ale and cider. The other had a little iron stovepipe at the back, and in front the placard, "Good firmity sold here." The man mentally weighted the two inscriptions, and inclined to the former tent.
"No, no, the other one," said the woman. "I always like firmity. So does Elizabeth Jane, and so will you. It is nourishing after a long, hard day."
"I've never tasted it," said the man.
However, he gave way to her representations, and they entered the firmity booth forthwith. At the upper end, over a large three-legged crock, a haggish creature of about 50 presided in a white apron. She slowly stirred the contents of the pot. The young man and woman ordered a basin each of the wheat mixture, steaming hot, and sat down to consume it at leisure. After a mincing attack on his bowl, the man watched the hag's proceedings from the corner of his eye, and saw the game she played. He winked to her, and passed up his basin in a reply to her nod, when she took a bottle from under the table, slyly measured out a quantity of its contents, and tipped the same into the man's firmity. The liquor poured in was rum. The man, as slyly, sent back money in payment. He found the concoction thus strongly laced much more to his satisfaction, though his wife had observed the proceeding with much uneasiness. The man finished his basin and called for another, the rum being signalled for in yet stronger proportion. The effect of it was soon apparent in his manner. The auctioneer selling the old horses in the field outside could be heard saying,
"Now this is the last lot. Now who'll take the last lot for a song? Shall I say 40 shillings? 'Tis a very promising brood mare, trifle over 5 year old."
Suddenly the hay trusser announced,
"For my part, I don't see why men who've got wives and don't want 'em shouldn't get rid of 'em, as these gypsy fellows do their old horses. Why shouldn't they put 'em up and sell 'em by auction to men who are in need of such articles, eh? Why, be gad, I'd sell mine this minute if anybody would buy her."
"Well, it's them that would do that," some of the other guests replied, looking at the woman who was by no means ill-favoured.
"Well then, now is their chance. I am open to an offer for this gem of creation."
The woman turned to her husband and murmured,
"Michael, You have talked this nonsense in public places before. A joke is a joke, but you may make it once too often, mind.
I know I've said it before, I meant it. Will anybody buy her?
I wish somebody would,
said she firmly.
Her present owner is not at all to her liking.
Nor you to mine, said he.
So we are agreed about that, gentlemen. You hear? It's an agreement to part. She shall take the girl, if she wants to, and go her ways. I'll take my tools and go my ways. Now then, stand up, Susan, and show yourself.
The woman stood up.
Now, who make an offer?
Cried the man. Nobody answered.
No bed,
said the husband.
I'll sell her for 5 guineas to any man that will treat her well. And he shall have her forever. And never he ought to me. Susan, you agree?
She bowed her head with absolute indifference.
5 guineas. Do anybody give it? Last time, yes or no?
Yes, said a loud voice from the doorway. All eyes were turned. Standing in the door of the tent was a sailor who, unobserved by the rest, had arrived there within the last 2 or 3 minutes. A dead silence followed his affirmation.
You say you do?
Asked the husband, staring at him.
I say so,
replied the sailor.
Saying is one thing, paying is another. Where's the money?
The sailor hesitated a moment, looked anew at the woman, came in, unfolded 5 crisp banknotes, and threw them down upon the tablecloth. Upon the face of this, he chinked down the shillings severally. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The sight of real money in full amount, in answer to a challenge for the same, till then deemed slightly hypothetical, had a great effect upon the spectators. Their eyes became riveted upon the faces of the chief actors, and then upon the notes as they lay, weighted by the shillings, on the table.
Now, said the woman, breaking the silence, if you touch that money, Michael, I and this girl go with the man. Mine, it is a joke no longer.
Joke? Of course it's not a joke,
shouted her husband.
I take the money, the sailor takes you. That's plain enough.
'Tis quite on the understanding that the young woman is willing, said the sailor blandly. I wouldn't hurt her feelings for the world.
Faith, nor I, said her husband, but she is willing.
That you swear?
Said the sailor to her.
I do,
said she, after glancing at her husband's face and seeing no repentance there.
Very well, the bargain's complete,
said the trusser. He took the sailor's notes and deliberately folded them, and put them with the shillings in a high remote pocket with an air of finality. The sailor looked at the woman and smiled.
Come along,
he said kindly.
The little one too. The more the merrier.
She paused for an instant with a close glance at him. Then, dropping her eyes again and saying nothing, she took up the child and followed him as he made towards the door. On reaching it, she turned and, pulling off her wedding ring, flung it across the booth in the hay trusser's face.
Mike, she said, I've lived with thee a couple of years and had nothing but temper. Now I'm no more to thee. I'll try my luck elsewhere. 'Twill be better for me and Elizabeth Jane both. So, goodbye.
Seizing the sailor's arm with her right hand and mounting the little girl on her left, she went out of the tent, sobbing bitterly. Perhaps from some little sense of having countenanced an indefensible proceeding, perhaps because it was late, the customers thinned away from the tent shortly after this episode. The hay trusser stretched his elbows forward on the table, leant his face upon his arms, and soon began to snore. The furmity seller decided to close for the night, and shook him, but could not wake him. As the tent was not to be struck that night, the fair continuing for 2 or 3 days, she decided to let the sleeper, who was obviously no tramp, stay where he was, and his basket with him. Extinguishing the last candle and lowering the flap of the tent, she left it and drove away. The morning sun was streaming through the crevices of the canvas when the man awoke. He looked about. Among the odds and ends on the grassy floor, he discerned a little shining object and picked it up. It was his wife's ring. A confused picture of the events of the previous evening seemed to come back to him, and he thrust his hand into his breast pocket. A rustling revealed the sailor's banknotes thrust carelessly in.
She's gone. To be sure she is. Gone with that sailor who bought her and little Elizabeth Jane. We walked here, and I had the firmity and rum in it and sold her. Yeah, that's what happened, and here I am. Now what am I to do? Am I sober enough to walk, I wonder?
He stood up and found that he was in fairly good condition for progress, unencumbered. Next, he shouldered his tool basket and found he could carry it. Then, lifting the tent door, he emerged into the open air. His conviction was that he must somehow find his wife and his little Elizabeth Jane and put up with the shame as best he could. It was of his own making, and he ought to bear it. But first, he resolved to register an oath, a greater oath than he had ever sworn before. He perceived the roofs of a village and the tower of a church. He instantly made towards the latter object. Opening the gate, he entered the sacrarium, where he seemed to feel a sense of the strangeness for a moment. Then he knelt upon the footpace. Dropping his head upon the clamped book which lay on the communion table, he said aloud,
I, Michael Henchard, on this morning of the 16th of September, do take an oath before God that I will avoid all strong liquors for the space of 21 years to come, being a year for every year that I have lived. And this I swear upon the book before me, and may I be struck dumb, blind, and helpless, if I break this, my oath.
The high road into the village of Weydon Priors was again carpeted with dust, and where the Henchard family of three had once walked along, two persons not unconnected with that family walked now. A long procession of years had passed by. One of the two who walked the road was she who had figured as the young wife of Henchard on the previous occasion. She was dressed in the mourning clothes of a widow. Her companion, also in black, appeared as a well-formed young woman, about 18. A glance was sufficient to inform the eye that this was Susan Henchard's grown-up daughter. Reaching the outskirts of the village, they pursued the same track as formerly and ascended to the fair. "Why did we hinder our time by coming here? I thought you wished to get onward," said the maiden.
"Yes, my dear Elizabeth Jane," explained the mother. "But I had a fancy for looking up here."
"Why?"
"It was here I first met with Newson, on such a day as this."
"First met with father here?"
"Yes, you have told me so before.
And now he's drowned and gone from us."
"And it was here," continued her mother, with more hesitation, "that I last saw the relation we are going to look for, Mr. Michael Henchard."
"What is his exact kin to us, mother? I've never clearly had it told me."
"He is, or was, for he may be dead, a connection by marriage," said her mother deliberately.
"I suppose he never knew me?"
the girl innocently inquired.
Mrs. Newson, as she called herself, paused for a moment and answered uneasily,
"Of course not, Elizabeth Jane. But come this way.